January 5th, 1976, interviewing Mr. Aaron, third session. Eleanor Langer and Marcia Frommerman. Mr. Aaron, could you tell us, did the servants who worked in your household, both as a youngster and when you were a grown man and in your own household, did they stay a short period of time or a long period of time?
I'm not an expert on the servant problem. Some of them stayed a long time, some of them stayed a shorter time. Some of them were immigrants, some of them presumably had grown up in this country. I can't give you details, really.
And when you were a child, from what countries did the servants come?
I recall several from Ireland. There were also governesses from Germany who were there primarily so that my sister and I could acquire facility in Germany.
I wonder if for a few moments we could talk about Bloomfield and the composition of Bloomfield, and maybe even you could give us a description of what it was like when you were growing up in that area.
Actually, we didn't think of our section as Bloomfield. Bloomfield was in the direction of town from where we lived, and the section in which we lived was known as Baum Grove. It was a pleasant residential section with trees. Most of the houses had a certain amount of ground, and as children, my sister and I went to Friendship School, which was a most excellent elementary school.
So you were there for through the sixth grade. You attended Friendship School.
I was a member of the first class that graduated from the eighth grade at Friendship School. And then during the days on Wineville Avenue, I also attended Osceola High School for the first half year of high school, and then Peabody High School for the other 3 years that I spent in high school. I think we spoke of that in one of the earlier sessions.
Yes, yes. So therefore, did you skip some grades through your schooling, throughout your school degree?
Apparently I did.
Did you receive any honors any time in your schooling, either secondary or post-secondary?
That's an embarrassing question. I graduated with highest honor from Peabody, and college, I was elected to Phi Beta Kappa.
Did you ever have any military service?
I went through military drill. I was under the draft age for registration in 1918 when the First World War ended. And therefore, I was not inducted in military service, but I was a member of the Student Army Training Corps at Princeton as an uninducted volunteer.
And you were with that organization?
During the fall of 1918, very brief period of time, and had previously been a member of the ROTC at Princeton. Engaged in military drill, but it was not a serious participation in the war, in any sense of the word.
I wonder if we could turn now to some of your comments about your father's work in public education. If you could describe for us what his role was.
Father was appointed to the Pittsburgh Board of Public Education in 1911 when the appointive board was first established under the school code of Pennsylvania. He served as a member of the Pittsburgh Board of Public Education for 36 years, succeeded Taylor Alderdice as vice president of the board, and in 1922 succeeded David B. Oliver as president of the board. He was president of the Pittsburgh board for 20 years and then continued as a member until 1947. Father was also appointed by Governor Brumbaugh, I believe, to the State Board of Education in 1916, served until 1921 when the State Board of Education was replaced by a State Council of Education. He continued with the State Council until 1923, when he resigned in protest against the refusal of Governor Pinchot to reappoint without attaching strings to his appointment, without refusal to reappoint Thomas E. Finnegan as superintendent of public instruction. Father felt very strongly that the superintendent of public instruction should be above any political consideration, and that it was totally unfair and a violation of the constitutional mandate that the superintendent of public instruction should be appointed for a four-year term, and thought that the governor had no right to say, "You give me your resignation before I appoint you." And then in the 40s, Father was reappointed again to the State Council of Education. That was a period when his health was not as good as it had been, and he did not take the same active part in the State Council that he had taken in the years in the 20s when he had been.
Do you happen to recall what your father mentioned as maybe some of the highlights of his term of office on the Pittsburgh Board of Education?
Well, I don't know that I can quote Father on that. I know that Father felt very strongly that it was of the utmost importance to any city to have good schools. He felt that the essence of good schools was a non-political organization, a control of the schools by a board completely dedicated to the cause of education and not seeking either selfish or political ends. And to that end, he devoted his efforts to the support of the superintendent of schools so that he could do the work of his office without interference by board members seeking favors either for themselves or for their friends. And carried on a battle in the legislature and elsewhere for adequate support for the public schools, so that it would be possible to pay adequate salaries to teachers, so that teachers would be properly compensated for their work. That was before the days of teachers' unions and the organization of the Pittsburgh Teachers Association, and they were most appreciative to Father for the support that he had given the teachers in all his his activity on the board and elsewhere.
I wonder if now we could turn to any, you're telling us if you belong to any organization that took a specific point of view on Israel or Zionism, and if so, were you active?
I have not been active in that field. At one time I was interested in the American Council for Judaism, but I did not participate as a member.
I wonder if you could tell us the dates that you were president of Rod of Sholem Congregation, as well as the dates that you served as a trustee.
I was elected as a trustee in 1943 and continued as an elected member of the board until 1973, I believe. Mm-hmm. Then I became an ex officio and an honorary trustee. I served as vice president of the congregation from 1949 to 1953, as president of the congregation from 1953 to 1972.
What was the task of a president of a congregation during those years?
The task of the president of the congregation was to preside over meetings of the Board of Trustees and preside at meetings of the congregation, and in general to maintain the integrity of the congregation.
Now, for someone who served the congregation for a few decades, would you say that your role changed from time to time, from that of an innovator to that of a conciliator, or did it stay fluid, or how would you describe it?
I don't know that I can answer the question. I don't think there was any conscious orientation on my part in one direction or another. I think that I saw my obligation to maintain the congregation as a vital factor in the lives of its members, and to that end, I was interested in seeing that its influence was as wide and as active as possible.
Do you know of any item or group of factors that might not be available for historians in the future in temple minutes that we ought to know about at this time?
Well, I think the record is written in the minutes and in the history of the congregation. I don't know if there's anything that I could add in particular.
So, in other words, the records are complete as far as you know?
I think reasonably so.
Okay, then I wonder if we could turn to some conversation about the Hebrew.
But the life of the congregation is not contained in the minutes of the meetings of the Board of Trustees. The life of the congregation is largely the interaction between the rabbi and the congregation. My own feeling is that it is not the board member and not the officer of the congregation, but the rabbi who is the vital factor in the creation of a living congregation.
During some previous hours together, you have well described for us the experiences with some of our former rabbis. Looking back now, would you say that though the styles of these rabbis that we have had serving us at Rosh Hashanah differed, that probably the style that was available at the time by the rabbi who served was what was probably needed by our congregation during that time?
Well, I would say definitely that the rabbi met the needs of the congregation, or he could not continue as rabbi. But my own feeling is that the opportunity exists always for the rabbi to make his influence felt in the congregation, and to the extent to which he does it effectively, the congregation will thrive, and if he fails to do it, the congregation will cease to be an effective force in the lives of its members. I don't mean that the rabbi is to do everything, but I think the rabbi must furnish the dynamic impetus to growth and development.
All right, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about Hebrew Union College. Could you tell us about your experience on the Board of Governors and what you presently do with the Hebrew Union College?
I became a member of the Board of Governors of the Hebrew Union College back in 1931, except for part of a four-year term when I had declined re-election to the board. I have been a member continuously until a year ago when I became an honorary member of the board. I have attended meetings, but I have always had the feeling that I lived too far from the center of operation to be an effective member of the board.
For those that live closer to Hebrew Union College, who do serve on the Board of Governors, do they take part in the decision-making of the college?
They take part in the decision-making. Others who do not live quite so close to the college also take part in the decision-making. But I think the opportunity is greater for those who are nearer at hand. It doesn't mean that the college has not had effective men who have lived elsewhere. Of course, at the present time, the Hebrew Union College operates in four locations: Cincinnati, New York, Los Angeles, and a school of biblical research and archaeology in Jerusalem. No one can be at all four places, and unfortunately that applies also to the president of the college. One of the difficulties is that he has constantly to be moving from one campus to the other in order to accomplish his work, but it represents a division of his time that must militate against the most effective use of his time and the greatest impact on his students. Of course, he can't be with them enough. There have been chairmen of the Board of Governors, such as Mr. Copal, who lived in Memphis, Tennessee, who did a magnificent job. And at the present time, Judge Tannenwald has just completed a term of service. He lived in Washington, D.C., and has been a member of the Tax Court of the United States, so that he hasn't been able to devote anything like full time to the work. Done an excellent job.
Have you seen any particularly interesting developments at the college since 1939?
Well, there's been a very great expansion of activity. In 1931, the Hebrew Union College was located in Cincinnati. There was only the one campus. Then, in 1947 or thereabouts, the Hebrew Union College had as its president Nelson Glick, and when Stephen Wise retired at Jewish Institute of Religion in New York, Nelson Glick was also elected to succeed Stephen Wise as president of the Jewish Institute of Religion, so the two institutions had one head, and then about 1950, if I recall correctly, the two institutions merged. So that since then, there were the two campuses, New York and Cincinnati. Subsequently, a third campus was established in Los Angeles, and with the establishment of the School of Biblical Research and Archaeology in Jerusalem, a fourth campus was added. So that there has been a great spreading out of the activity of the institution and reaching out beyond the actual borders of the United States.
You touched upon something we're interested in. You talked about, we're interested in the people who headed up the Hebrew Union College and the differences between the people. Would you be able to give us any more information about that?
Well, the period of dynamic growth and extension of activity occurred during the presidency of Nelson Glick. Nelson Glick was an archaeologist and a biblical scholar. He was also an extremely active and dynamic person, and he made his influence felt wherever he went. It was certainly due to Nelson Glick that the period of expansion developed as it did. His successor, Dr. Gottschalk, is endeavoring to carry on, but he is confronted with an established situation, which he has these four branches of the institution to direct, and I think he's found that quite a sufficient challenge to keep him more than busy.
I wonder if now we could focus on some earlier years. Could you tell us how it is that you met your wife and how long you knew her before you got married?
I met my wife at Vassar College in April 1923, when I was visiting Vassar with my parents to hear my sister participate in an intercollegiate debate. My wife was also a debater, but on that occasion she was assigned to the duty of welcoming one of the judges of the debate, and I met her just for a moment at the reception after the debate. And subsequently, in 1924, my wife and her parents were in Europe. I was in Europe with my parents and sister. My sister persuaded the Goldmark family to come to St. Moritz where we were, and we were together there for 4 days. And in 1926, we became engaged, and were married in June of that year.
And your marriage took place where?
We were married in New York City, and our good friend Dr. Goldenson came from Pittsburgh to marry us.
Were you married at what temple?
We were not married in a temple. We were married at actually a restaurant at which the wedding took place. Not in the dining room, but in private rooms for that purpose.
Then, after your marriage, you came to live directly. You came. Where did you go on your honeymoon? And then we'll talk about where you lived.
Well, we went to Europe, and we retraced in 1926 some of the walks that we had taken together in 1924. And in the fall, we returned to Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh has been our home ever since.
And when you returned from your honeymoon, What address did you and your wife go to?
Well, we stayed briefly with my parents on Hillsborough Avenue, then sublet an apartment at the Ruskin, but were there only a few months. My parents were away that winter. We moved back to their house while they were away, and then found a house of our own on Woodmont Street that spring and moved there in June, if I recall correctly.
And how long did you stay on Woodmont Street?
We were there for 5 years and then moved to this house in Vinesse.
And you've been here since that time?
Been here since the 1st of March, 1932.
Has this street changed much since you moved in 32?
There have been changes, not too many. Most of the houses were here at that time, but there have been one or two new ones. One house has been eliminated in the next block.
Now, could you tell us about your children? How many and when they were born?
We have four children. Our eldest daughter, Maxine, born in 1927. Our son, Marcus Aaron II, born in 1929. Our daughter, Frances, was born in 1933, and our daughter, Eleanor, Mrs. James S. Langer, who is here this evening, was born on the last day of 1935.
And could you tell us where your children went to school, and if they went into any careers, and where are they now?
The children started briefly at a private school, at least three of them did, called the Colonial School up on Murray Avenue, and then transferred to Whiting School and went on to Taylor Alderdice. And my youngest daughter took her kindergarten work at Shadyside Academy, of all places, and then went to Whiting School on through Alderdice. And all three daughters went to Vassar College. My son went to Princeton and to Harvard Law School. Our eldest daughter continued her education with 2 years of graduate work at the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University. And Frances and Eleanor both took a graduate year at Radcliffe for a Master of Arts in Teaching. Both of them went on to teach. And our son went into the law, and my daughter, who had studied the history of art, was married while she was taking her graduate work. And now that her children have grown up, she has become deeply interested and is making almost a career of volunteer work at the museums in San Francisco.
So therefore you have how many children living in town and how many living out of town?
Two children out of town, Maxine, who lives in Lafayette, California, Francis, who lives in Benko, Illinois, Marcus II, and Eleanor, who lived in Pittsburgh.